Okay, today the title of my talk is Black and White in West Africa. It's actually going to be it's a combination of a very personal kind of talk, because what I want to do is I want to talk about some of my own experiences and feelings having lived in the country of Ghana, for those of you who weren't here last time. Ghana is in Africa. The part of Africa they call West Africa, and right here on the coast of the Atlantic Ocean. I've drawn a big map of Ghana down below so you can see it a little bit better. It's surrounded by the countries, the Ivory Coast. On this map it still says Upper Volta. Those of you who have watched Africa very closely, you find out that countries change their names pretty quickly and often. Now, within the last 2 years, this country of Upper Volta has become Burkina Faso. So keep that one in mind. And then on the other side is Togo. Now, most Americans aren't so familiar with West Africa, but two countries they usually know about are Liberia and Nigeria. Okay, so Ghana would be found right in the middle of those, with a few countries in between. My wife and I went to Ghana as missionaries with the Lutheran Church in America, and in the next couple sessions I'll be talking to you more about the particular people and the particular churches that we're working with. They are called African Independent Churches. That is, churches that are not directly tied to the mainline churches, which have historical mission connections with missions in the United States and in Europe. I will be talking, though, today a little bit about some of the history of Ghana. And when one talks about the history of Ghana, one necessarily talks about the activities of missions and the church. That's also part of, in my theme, Black and White in West Africa. Because quite a few of the missionaries, of course, were white. And the population of West Africa is black. I'd like to start out by an experience that we had. Okay, we arrived on November 25th, 1981. And we were planning to be living in the capital city of Accra. But our house wasn't available at that time, so we were put in a place in the city of Tema. It's an industrial city 19 miles away from Accra. And we decided to visit the Lutheran Church. There is a Missouri Synod Lutheran-related church in Ghana. And so we decided to visit that church on the first Sunday that we happened to be there. Of course, when you go to a new and different country, you don't know what's coming off. You know, there's always anticipation as well as a little bit of apprehension as to what things are going to be like. Well, we went to the service. We enjoyed it quite a bit. And immediately after the service, a woman came up to us and, in a very, very friendly manner, started talking with us and invited us. Okay, she runs a small cocoa drink stand in the market in the city of Tema. And she invited us to come the next day and start to learn something about Ghana at her cocoa drink stand in the market. We couldn't think of a better way to learn about a country than that. And as she kept talking about it, talking about herself and so forth, we learned that her husband is a fairly high up supervisor at the Volta Aluminum Company, which is known in Ghana as Valco. It's a subsidiary of Kaiser Aluminum, which has its headquarters, I understand, in Seattle. I'm not in Seattle, but in Spokane. And I think the summer before, through the company, her husband was on a three-month study leave in Spokane, and she was able to come along for 1 month. And basically, the reception that she gave us was the result of people being friendly and nice and good to her in Spokane, and she wanted to return it to us when we visited her country. And so maybe that's the basis of what I want to say about black and white in West Africa. It has a lot to do with how individuals are treated. And if you can do a small thing, you know, maybe it will have some impacts that you don't even know about. Who knows, maybe some of you are from Spokane, and maybe some of you helped entertained her or whatever, you know. But I just wanted to mention that. And in fact, this family has remained a very good friend of ours throughout the whole time we have been in Ghana. Okay. I thought quite a few of you would be interested in this issue of color and how races get along together, because I've discovered since I've been back in the States for a month and a half now, and another month and a half I'll be going back to Ghana, I've discovered that here in the States you have been hearing a lot about Africa, a lot more about Africa than I remember having heard back in 1981 when I was first going to Ghana. You have very much in your minds South Africa and Ethiopia, I believe. There are a couple things I want to emphasize, and I mentioned this in the last session a little bit. Africa is a big place. If you work at it, you can fit the United States three times in the continent of Africa. Communication and transportation in the continent of Africa is not nearly so good as it is here in the United States. For example, you all know that there is a very large Sahara Desert right here. There is no permanent road that really goes through that. You can't take Interstate, 73 or something like that to get across the Sahara Desert. A lot of people are going across the desert. It's a very favored thing for young Germans and Frenchmen to come go through, enter Africa through Morocco, and then go down through Algeria and Niger and get down into West Africa on motorcycles or all-terrain kinds of vehicles. But even that is actually risky, and quite a few people even now lose their lives doing that, although it's because going through the desert is very, very unpredictable. Okay, so transportation is not very good this way. If, for example, if we wanted to go from Ghana to Morocco, most likely we would fly to London and then back. Or we would fly to Rome and back, or something like that. Okay. Then if you want to go this way, if any of you know much about this part of Africa, it's very, very dense jungle. And one time we had the opportunity of flying on Ethiopian Airways, one of the best airways in in Africa, by the way, from Accra to Lagos, and then over to Nairobi, Kenya, and then the flight itself then went on to Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. as we flew over here, we flew for about 2 hours, in which all I could see from the plane were trees. There were no roads, no visible rivers, that could be navigable. And from what I understand, if you want to take a drive from Nigeria, for example, over to Kenya or Ethiopia, you really can't do it. You really can't do it. A few people, with specially equipped vehicles maybe have been able to make it, but it's practically impossible. So the only way to connect these parts of Africa are by plane. Another interesting thing is somebody in Nairobi once needed to telephone me in Accra. I got the call, and it was a London operator mediating that telephone call. Just a few things. Okay, so what happens over here in this part of Africa doesn't have a whole lot to do with what happens here in terms of daily life, simply because there is not very good connections between the parts. Okay, and if you want to consider South Africa, it's even more difficult. Because basically you'd have to fly over here and then down to South Africa if you wanted to have some connection. So West Africa and South Africa have very little connection. They also have very little in common in terms of history and experiences. So I'm saying all of this because I want to warn you against lumping all of Africa together. And because I've had people come up to me and say, well, I don't know the name, John Doe or something, he's in some place in South Africa. Do you know him? You know, it's really about the same as asking, do I know so-and-so living over in Czechoslovakia? Because I'm so close here in the United States. You know, so I want to impress that on you. All of Africa is not the same. Now, there are some commonalities that happen to run across quite a bit of Africa, especially, I could say, across this area of Africa, where a lot of the people have a somewhat similar cultural heritage. But then it is, again, fairly different in the southern part of Africa and extremely different in the northern part of Africa, which has a more Arabic, Middle Eastern flavor and nature. I hope I've said that clearly. Now, to move on, I would like to concentrate a little bit more specifically on some of the history of the area around where we are living in what is now called Ghana. Now, I'll be going through the history because I think it will also help explain some of the experiences that we have had. Ghana originally, of course, was not one country. In reading through the history of Ghana, now that some of the historians are starting to look a little bit further before pre-colonial days, it's quite interesting when you compare the history in Ghana with the history in Europe, for example, of the 15th and 16th centuries. Ghana, very much like the various small European kingdoms, was full of small kingdoms throughout this whole area and not necessarily defined within these particular borders. I'm going to be talking primarily about one kingdom that, as far as historical records can be traced, come to about this part of the country in what is presently the Brong-Ahafo region. And the name of that group has come to be Ashanti, if any of you have heard of that particular name. Okay, the Ashantis migrated a little bit south and through doing the same thing as various groups were doing in Europe, fighting with each other. Some lost wars and some won wars. If you won, then you would have vassal states that would then be paying tribute to you, and you would develop mightier and mightier empires and kingdoms. One of the groups from around in this area moved down into this area right here. Dentshuri kingdom is the name of it. And that particular group started becoming quite powerful and got vassal kingdoms throughout, you could say, most of this part of Ghana, which, considering transportation and communication and everything at those times, was a very, very large kingdom, probably larger than most of those that you would have had in Europe at that time. The wealth of this kingdom came largely through gold as well as human services, slavery and so forth. Okay, slavery did not begin with the slave trade. In fact, one time I was reading, somebody was trying to trace it way back. Somebody said that slavery was actually introduced over the desert and down into West Africa. And it was very much a local thing. They talked about three different classes of people, the king, the person who is ruling, and then an elite group of people, you could say the aristocracy, and then the common people. Okay, those were real people, and then underneath those were the slaves. And Slaves could be slaves for life, even passed on from generation to generation, or they could be people who, sounds just like Europe, couldn't pay a debt, and so had to work for other people until the debt was paid off, and they lost most of their rights and so forth. So this kingdom was quite large, prospered quite a bit during the 1400s, in other words, the 15th century, 1400s. It was during that time that this part of Africa had its first contact with Europe, basically. I think when I was in school, I learned a little ditty about Columbus in, what was it, 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue? Well, before 1492, Columbus was sailing the ocean blue, because in 1480, he actually landed on the coast of Ghana. And it was before his expedition to try and find the way, another way around the world. And the Portuguese were starting to set up trading colonies, or not trading colonies, but trading posts along the west coast of Africa in the early 1400s. I think 1417 was the first recorded stop. Okay, and what was happening was the Portuguese then, you know, they didn't come as colonial masters or anything at that time. They came and they saw that there were certain valuable trading commodities, gold, silver, and that's largely what they were looking for at that particular time. And so they established just a small colony, small group of traders, and which then they had to rent the land that they were on and also be paying tribute to whatever king was in charge of that area. That was basically the way things continued to work out for the next, what would it be, three centuries, from 1400 up until the early 1800s. And so as the trade grew and became much, much more lucrative, it was also in the advantage of the kings of these various empires in Ghana to have control over the coastal trading ports so that they could control the trade also. So we had then in the early 1400s the first contacts with the traders. The Portuguese were the first ones. English and Dutch tried a few attempts, but they were not nearly as successful in the very early part as Portuguese. Now I'll just mention something about establishment of Christianity in Ghana. The Portuguese, of course, were Catholic at that time. I guess in 1400s you wouldn't have any of the Protestant denominations. And anyway, Portugal remained a Catholic country. They, at their trading port, brought priests. The idea of the priests was not so much to be evangelizing the natives, as they were called, but actually to serve as chaplains for the traders that were there. That was a pattern that actually remained throughout the 18th century, you could say. There wasn't a lot of concerted effort at having all that much contact to do with the native Ghanaians. Okay, because of the prosperity of all of the trading, especially with gold, this part of Africa, which was first known as Guinea, the entire, people would be talking about going to Guinea and they could be going to Nigeria or Ghana or Liberia, you know, anywhere along the coast. This whole part of Africa was known as Guinea. As people started to have more contact with it, as the Europeans started to have more contact with it, they started differentiating between the different parts, and this area got to be known as the Gold Coast. And that's the name that actually this country ended up having until it achieved independence in 1957. They noticed the country next to it is called Ivory Coast. So apparently they were getting more ivory out of that part and more gold out of this part. This particular empire, the Dentchery Empire, was actually a fairly harsh and brutal empire. And that was partly what brought about its downfall. It remained for quite a while. I think it was in the year 1701 that one of its vassal states, the Ashanti, was sent a message to the king of the Ashanti that he had to provide, I think it was 4 fairly large headpans filled with pure gold powder. Plus, of all of the nobles in the land, they had to give up their most preferred wives and send them down to the emperor of the Daenerys. And then they also had to kill each of their firstborn. Well, the king of the Ashanti didn't particularly like that. And at that time, they were fairly strong. And so they waged war against the Denchiri and had a few decisive battles and eventually were successful. They assumed the ascendancy. And so the major large grouping and empire was in this area known as the Ashanti. And that's actually very significant because if one ever hears or thinks about Ghana, usually one thinks about the Ashantis. They have somehow retained their cultural identity and gotten known around the world quite a bit, even up till today. Okay, the Ashantis then were fairly powerful with vassal states all around, which then they derived the revenues of gold and silver and just anything that they needed. But one of the primary things was to get the access to the coast, because that's where now in the 17th and 18th centuries the really lucrative trade was starting to begin. So there was another group that had broken off from the very beginning, which was called the Fantes, F-A-N-T-E, Fantes. And they established themselves in the area of Cape Coast, and they actually had a very preferred position in the trade. So there was always a lot of fighting among these different groups and so forth. And actually, as the trading went on, the prosperity that the trading brought actually did not bring a whole lot of peace. And as the trading shifted from commercial goods to slave trading, as it was ended up primarily being throughout the 18th and the early part of the 19th century, how would you go about getting slaves if you know all the slaves you had were depleted that you wanted to be selling off? Well, you would go wage a war against one of your neighboring countries, capture a lot of slaves, and then sell them. And so the slave trade also initiated a lot of intertribal warfare within the country. Okay, during that time, okay, the Portuguese actually, you could say, started with some of the slave trade. But while they were in power, it was primarily the trade of commercial goods. Some of the early documents show that some of the things they brought in were brassware, brass pots and various things like that, as well as certain finished cotton textiles. And in exchange for that, then went gold and silver and so forth. As time went on, the trading shifted towards slavery, but that really only got going after the Dutch gained ascendancy in that area in the within the 1700s. And I think some of you may have heard about the Trading Triangle or something like that, whereby you could say, let's start from the Netherlands. The Dutch would send their ship with textiles and various manufactured goods from Europe, take it down to the west coast of Africa, trade those goods for slaves, take the slaves over to South and North America, who would then work on the plantations and develop the raw materials for Europe's manufacturing of sugar, cotton, and, well, you all know what kinds of things were being produced in this country and in South America. And so that came to be a very, very lucrative triangle, which it wasn't until mid-1800s that finally the slave trade was abolished and broke up that particular system. So, okay, I've mentioned the Dutch, I've mentioned the Portuguese. Also around the time of the Dutch, the British also established several trading colonies, and the Danish. A few other countries tried, but were not so successful. During the early 1800s, the British started to be getting the upper hand over the Dutch and the Danes. The Danes had a castle in a part of what is now Accra called the Christiansborg Castle. And the British were finally ended up taking over a major castle. Well, they built a castle at a place called Cape Coast. The oldest castle in Ghana, still standing, you can go and tour it if you want, is the Elmina Castle, in Portuguese, apparently for the mine, because of the gold that was gotten there, which actually then came to be a major place, point of the slave trade, just near Cape Coast. Finally, the British gained ascendancy over most of these trading places, and the British then began a program where they started through treaties of friendship and also some forced treaties to gain control, not over the country as a whole, but gain control of the trade for themselves from the various local tribes. And it was eventually that procedure that then gave them the control over the whole area of the Gold Coast. It wasn't through military conquest, as you could say, but simply through various treaties and dealings and, you know, I'll be a friend of you if you're an enemy with me, this other tribe, and so forth. And then they finally gained ascendancy in the early 1800s. How shall I go on? Now, maybe I'll start mentioning also, because it's interwoven with this, even though most of the history is treated separately, because one often hears that the Christian missionaries came in, you know, with the help of the colonialists and so forth. In Ghana, the feeling is somewhat different. The feeling is that the missionaries began to start coming a little bit before the colonial process, and throughout the history, even though many times they were right along with it, they somehow remained a little bit independent of it. As I said, the early introduction of Christianity to Ghana wasn't an intention to Christianize or evangelize the Ghanaian people, but was to provide chaplains. And that had that basic effect. There, for about three or four centuries, there was almost no Christianity spread outside of the traders from the various ports. However, there was a certain amount of intermarriage between some of these coastal tribes and the traders. And those then the offspring of those marriages, then having the contact with Europe, as well as some of the contact with the local peoples, provided a little bit of what could you say, understanding or receptiveness to this new religion that was coming. But even then, it didn't spread very far. It was until, I have a, where, oh, right here. The first group to really come into Ghana was the Basel Mission Society, based in Basel, Switzerland. You could say, with strong Lutheran underpinnings. However, it was an independent, it was not a church mission as such, it was an independent missionary society. And so there were also Swiss Reformed people involved in it. They came to the area near Accra and started establishing some missionary outposts. Shortly after that, in 1833, the Wesleyan Methodist Missionary Society established a few beachheads, you could say, in the area of Cape Coast, where the British had their trading point, major trading point. Then, the further over, in the area near Togo and on the other side of the Volta River, the North Bremen Mission Board sent some missionaries and started work in this area. In 1847. In 1880, the Society of African Mission of the Catholic Church then decided to start a specific mission program in which it also came to the area near Cape Coast. Okay, those are the ones that I'll be mentioning right now. There was also the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel, which ended up in the formation of the Anglican Church that also established itself somewhat in Cape Coast, but also had influence in Accra. These very, very early missionaries soon learned why this part of Africa was not used as a place for, you could say, repatriating or colonizing Europeans, such as places like South Africa and Kenya had come to be, because they knew the meaning of the white man's graveyard. Because these missionary societies would send out about 8 or 10 missionaries, and after about 1 year or 2 years, one or two of those missionaries would come back. The rest of them had died of malaria primarily, as well as other fevers that nobody knows exactly what they would have been. Through quite a few repeated attempts of that, when you read the history, it's amazing why they kept sending people. You know, and you know, who on earth would volunteer to go into a situation like that? You know, where just 2 years ago they had sent out a party of 16 and none of them returned. You know, who would volunteer to go into a situation like that? So I think you have to admire very much the commitment of some of those early missionaries, the way that actually Ghanaian Christians now do. Anyway, they went and they began to do evangelizing in the areas of Cape Coast and, well, in the area of Accra, people were just faring so badly that finally certain of the missionaries moved a little bit up the country to where there was a fairly high mountain range and started doing their work there, living there. The amount of altitude difference was just enough to reduce, I guess, the number of mosquitoes that were carrying the malaria so that the missionaries could survive. And so the Presbyterian Church, formed from the Basel Mission Society, then really had its first impact in an area called Agouri and Akrapong, a little bit further up. The Methodists had their impact in Cape Coast. The Bremen Mission Society, you could say, had its impact there. And then the Basel Mission Society had its impact here. The Bremen Mission Society had its impact among the Ewe people here, who I haven't yet mentioned, but they're a significant tribal grouping in Ghana and Togo. As the time went on, the Christian church very, very much flourished in the southern part of Ghana. And I'll jump very quickly, but through the next 50 years, you could say that probably about 25% of the people in this area professed themselves to be Christians in some manner or another, following either the Basel Mission Society or the Methodists or the Catholic, later on the SVD, the Divine Word Fathers, also joined the Catholic efforts, and the Anglican efforts, as well as the Grayman Mission Society efforts. Now, Christianity was not coming onto, you could say, virgin territory. There were, of course, the traditional religions. The next talk I'll be talking a little bit more about traditional religions, because they have a lot to do with the further development of Christianity. So, as Christianity spread, its influence spread, and Ghanaians give most of the credit to the spread of Christianity through two basic efforts that some of the early missionaries had. One was the effort at education, and the other was the effort at translating, at reducing the languages, the local languages, to writing, and then translating the Bible and so forth. And so that gave the local Ghanaians a lot of opportunity that they did not have otherwise. And in fact, it had tremendous impact. It still does a lot today. Well, Christianity spread very, very quickly. And now, actually, some statistics show that approximately 50% of all Ghanaians say that they are Christians today. In the north, Christianity has had much, much less impact. Islam is a major religion there, but I would say that even now, from what people who are living up in the north of Ghana tell me, that probably the primary religion are the traditional religions. Okay. What am I doing? Okay, I talked a little bit about the earlier history, the establishment of the colony, and then the establishment of the Christian Church in Ghana. Now, through the early 20th century, okay, we had the Basel Mission Society working and being very, very strong here, and the Bremen Mission Society being very strong here. During the First World War, this area of the Gold Coast was already a British colony, and the German missionaries with those two societies, of course, were suspect, and so were all expelled. As a result of that, the Scottish Presbyterian Church was asked to send missionaries to cover that particular work. After the war, the German missionaries came back, and I guess the Scots went back to Scotland. And then during the Second World War, the same thing happened again. After the Second World War, the Presbyterians stayed. However, and so we have, as a result of the work of the Basel Mission Society, what is now the Presbyterian Church of Ghana, as the work of the Bremen Mission Society, the Evangelical Presbyterian Church of Ghana. Okay, the Presbyterian Church and the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, along with the Methodist Church and the Anglican Church, are now the four main churches in Ghana on the Protestant side. The Catholic Church is also very large. Okay. Okay, then coming up to more modern times, as Ghana, the Gold Coast was the first British colony to gain its independence from the colonial master. I won't go into a lot of detail as to the things that were leading up to it. However, the Ghanaians felt that, Ghanaians were traditionally very independent kind of people. And as they looked back into their history, they didn't see why they should be subdued by a colonial master, having, you know, a lot of the agreements having been treaties of friendship and so forth. And possibly something, a British policy may have also led to this particular event, is that for probably even since the Portuguese were there, the people in this part of Africa were considered to be more intelligent than in other parts of Africa by the colonizing powers. So the British had a conscious policy of not sending a lot of British people into the country, but just having a few governors and a few civil servants and so forth throughout the country. They also, along with the missionaries, established a very solid educational system, which through from the late 19th century and into the early 20th century produced a lot of very, very well-educated Ghanaians who then, of course, I think education brings about a desire for feelings of ruling your own fate a little bit too, and understanding of how to deal with the European mindset and so forth. And so that helped lead to this particular event. In the late, in about 1947 to 1949, the feelings for independence were starting to grow up, especially after a lot of Ghanaians had been conscripted by the British and served overseas. For example, our next-door neighbor in Accra, Ofori Kuma, he died just a couple of years ago, but he was very proud of the medals he had received fighting in Burma in the Second World War. They felt, during the war they had been fighting alongside British soldiers and so forth and gaining that kind of recognition. I think all of those things led to a feeling that they should be rulers of their own fate. So in 47 to 49, there were increasing voices for independence, and the British were a little bit repressive in the return, in trying to slow that down, which ended up kindling a lot more feeling. And about that time, with a very well-educated elite of people who were striving toward independence, a person who had grown up in a small town from a small tribe in Ghana, who wanted to go and study in the United States to further his well-being, had traveled as a stowaway from Ghana to Lagos, and then found somebody who would finance his trip to the United States, studied economics and law and I think social philosophy here, then went back to London, was called to come and lead one of the parties that was striving for independence. The name was Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. I think some of you may have known the name. Anyway, he was a real figurehead at organizing the people of Ghana to be putting pressure on the British colonial masters for independence. And the British, I think, saw that their time was coming to an end in Ghana, and so started working fairly rapidly toward a turnover of government. By 1951, even though the Gold Coast was still a British colony, most of the internal workings of government were being run by Ghanaians themselves. In 1957, independence was granted, and the Gold Coast then became Ghana, the first black African nation to achieve independence, as I said. The first president was Kwame Nkrumah. Kwame, by the way, means he was born on Saturday. All Ghanaians have name day names. Our daughter was born on Tuesday, so she's Abena. Anyway, he was the first president of Ghana. He moved in directions that were a little bit different than the people who had brought him to Ghana had been wishing for. He was, even though he had never lived in a socialist country, he had just lived in outside of Ghana, he had lived in the United States and Britain. He had some socialist ideals for Ghana. He was also very interested in making Ghana into an industrial rather than an agricultural nation. And so at the very beginning, he started in a very quick way to bring in a lot of development projects, which included a lot of building. For example, Takoradi was the only natural port in Accra. Within 10 years, Takoradi was the natural port in Ghana. Within 10 years, he had built the a harbor, a new complete harbor, and an industrial city, Tema, just outside of Accra, near the capital. Okay, that has been a real boost for the country of Ghana to have that particular port, and a city where industry is was being developed and encouraged. They had various kinds of industries, steel, textiles, petroleum refinery, refining, textiles is a big one, various plastic production and so forth. So one of his efforts was to develop industry, and of course to improve that one needed to have better transportation, so he did a lot of work at improving the roads. In fact, people are a little bit surprised in coming to Ghana from other West African and even other African countries for that, as to how good the basic road system is. We have a lot of tarred roads and so forth. He also did a lot of building around Accra. We happen to be living in a development house that was built during his time. All the houses on our street are of the same format, just turned around and in that. So we have, you know, suburban development during his time. And so he was doing a lot of those kind of things. When the British turned over Ghana to local or to self rule, Ghana was a very prosperous country. It had over 200 million pounds in reserve and almost no foreign debt. Nkrumah's very, very ambitious development programs wiped out almost all of the reserves that the country had. And that was one of the things that led to his downfall, as people were starting to realize that this couldn't go on. Also, Nkrumah had a vision for Ghana as being the country that would unite all of Africa. And he was one of the founding members of the Organization of African Unity, OAU, as well as the All African National Congress or something like that. There was another organization that was trying to unify Africa. Okay, his socialist policies also were leading him to discourage private enterprise and encourage the government as taking over more and more major parts of the industry. So the financial institutions were primarily, the independent financial institutions were put out of business by government-controlled corporations and banks. The industry was controlled by government and so forth. Well, all of that was going on, and people even today credit him with a lot of good that was done to Ghana. However, by 1966, okay, the country gained independence in 57, so 9 years later, when he was out of the country, actually what he was in Hanoi trying to arrange a settlement of the Vietnam War at the time when the army took over. It was a joint effort of the army and police took over and said that he was no longer leader of the country, and then began a military and police government of the country. And that government was then trying to keep the country from falling apart further. Okay, at the time of independence, a new currency was issued, the cedi, and actually cedi means in the Chui, the Ashanti language, a cowrie shell, which was one of the traditional forms of currency. The cedi was equal in value to $1. Okay, by the time Nkrumah was deposed, they were in need of devaluing the currency to, what was it, the cedi was going to be then, wait, let's go the other way around. This always gets confusing to me. you would have to use 1.2 cedis per dollar, and people were finding that unacceptable because the strength of the country, all of these industrial schemes, many of them were beginning to get quite corrupt, were not bringing in the income that the country needed, and therefore the value of the currency was going down. Also, another thing I want to mention is, in order to get his policies through, Nkrumah turned out to be a person who could not tolerate opposition. As early as 1959, he passed what they called the Preventive Detention Act, which meant that if you opposed him, you could be put into prison without trial, and you could be arrested and put into prison. Simple as that. By 1963, he had abolished all other political parties other than his own, and had basically taken control of his own political party and control of the entire government. So he was allowing no opposition, which also is a good way, I think, to make dissent from those who would like to oppose. Well, when the Preventive Detention Act was passed, one of his primary opponents left the country, stayed in England for quite a few years until after his overthrow. So anyway, it was all of those things that ended up leading to his overthrow. Following that, then there was a military police alliance running the country, and they started putting some more emphasis in agriculture. They stopped a lot of his very grandiose development projects. Actually, it seems that he was planning on having a United States of Africa with Accra as its capital. And in Accra now, even now, a building that's being used as the state house was built by him. They call it a white elephant, as a place that was going to be sort of the Congress of this United States of Africa. And many people feel that he had ambitions to be the president of that United States. But people felt like he was really selling his own country for his own grandiose dreams. Well, a lot of these very, very ambitious projects were then cut out by the military and police. And they started to try to develop some agricultural projects and get things back on track. And after a couple years then, they weren't doing so well, and they were also accused of corruption. They were replaced by a civilian regime that was brought into being by election, in which one of these exiled opponents came back and took over as president. That person took over as president in 1969. In 1972, he was overthrown by another military coup, in which then Colonel Achiampong, accusing this person of corruption and patronism and so forth, then took over. Well, Achiampong had a very heavy hand again on the country. Achiampong stayed in power from 1972 to 1979, during which the history books will generally describe he totally ruined Ghana's economy. There was a lot of patronism. Achiampong was fairly uneducated, and he had complete control over the country's finance, the economic moves that the country was taking. And during the time of Achiampong, the cedi ended up having to be devalued all the way to 2.75 cedis to a dollar. So it was almost one third of the value as it had been at the time of independence. Well, things continued to seem to go downhill under Achiampong's regime. People were getting less and less happy with it. And so finally there was a lot of pressure, and there was a new constitution drawn up. And in June 19th of 1979, there were to be elections for a civilian government then to take over. Well, on June 4th, 1979, a flight lieutenant from the army and a bunch of junior officers staged a coup at that particular time. This person's name was J.J. Rawlings. And his major idea was to clean up the country. So what he did was So he took over, and apparently it was a very ruthless kind of coup with quite a bit of bloodshed. And the soldiers sort of went mad and just looted civilians' homes, shops, everything. But Rawlings was trying to clean up things, and so what he did was he publicly executed quite a few of the former leaders of the country who had been in prison since they had been ousted and so forth. Well, he basically executed a lot of people just as an effort to clean up the country. He started what they called People's Revolutionary Courts. Okay, I'm talking too long. This is supposed to be more discussion. During which the People's Revolutionary Courts, where people would be tried for corruption and then could get anything to the death sentence, to prison sentences and so forth. Well, this lasted for 2 months, and he felt that the country was, I guess, cleaned up enough, and then he handed it over to the people who had been elected, and that was President Leman. Okay, when I arrived in Ghana in November 25 of 1981, okay, Leman started in 79, Leman was still president. When we arrived, we had 1 month's grace, and then there was a military coup in which J.J. Rawlings took over again. And this time it was described by the international press as a bloodless coup. However, we know that probably several thousand people died in this particular attempt.